Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week we are incognito, going undercover in a daring attempt to remain undetected behind enemy lines. I am wearing the biggest, bushiest moustache I could muster, while my partner in podcrime is wearing the biggest, moustachiest bush he could muster. We are both wearing glasses. Mine are a pair of sunnies balanced imperiously on the end of my nose, while his are improbably large opera glasses glued to his right cheek. And I don't mean the cheek of his face. If this doesn't deflect suspicion, then perhaps our coats might do the trick. Mine is a trench coat turned up at the collar to shield me from prying eyes. His is a coat of thick emulsion, a colour Dulux calls spy green, I'm told. And we're doing our utmost to blend into our surroundings, me with my perfect mastery of the local language and him with his perfect mastery of speaking loudly and slowly in a vaguely foreign accent. And finally, I've adopted an alias to complete the disguise. I am Count Hermann von Schnauzer Spritz, heir to the Schnauzer Spritz Crystal Empire, Central European playboy, raconteur and card aficionado, beloved of the tabloids, the chattering classes and the ladies of the Côte d'Azur. And alongside me is the Ben Vandeveld to my, it's already an implausible name, so he didn't have to make up an alias, Ben Vandeveld.
Hello.
You're right.
Yeah, this happens to me all the time, just because I have a faintly European name. People think that it's a stage name.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is...
No one would choose to call someone Ben Vandeveld.
I mean, no one would choose to call me what I'm actually called, which is Benjamin Roger Morris Vandeveld.
This is true. We
which is too much. Thing is, the thing is, Vandeveld just means farmer, but it's a surname that really encourages... titles like Professor or Baron before
it. Yeah, you should have several letters after your name.
I do.
As if you don't already have enough letters in your name.
Yeah, it's like Benjamin Vandeveld still sounds more implausibly aristocratic than Count Hermann von Schnauzer Spritz.
I know, I'm very proud of the name Count Hermann von Schnauzer Spritz. I'm going to keep it in the back pocket for a play I write someday.
That's not going to be a play. Yeah. That's going to be a high-end pantomime.
Yeah, or some very, very sexy role-play, my husband.
Our guest this week is a former pro wrestler that was forced into retirement because of injuries, as all pro wrestlers are, and so transferred that passion to his local National Hockey League team, who hired him as an official superfan. He comes in at a height of 5'9", weighing at 230 pounds, born in the icy confines of Smashville, Nashville, Tennessee. He is the masked man of Broadway, challenges all for supremacy of the Bridgestone Arena. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the Ultimate Predator!
I was waiting for my music.
Hang on, what's your walk-on track, Ulti? Did you used to have walk-on music?
I did. I would sit and play around on my computer and mix my own.
Oh, nice.
So I would just take samplings of other songs. The last one I mixed, I put a couple of Queen songs together, starting with We Will Rock You and ending with I Want It All.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Good sporting music,
yeah, and epic. You want to if you're coming on calling yourself if you're calling yourself the Ultimate Predator, you've got to come on to some properly epic music.
Oh, it's got to be, you know, something huge, something that just doesn't fit unless it's in an arena somewhere.
We are very, very excited to have you on the show because you're a listener as well, which is really nice. And you, and then we discover that sometimes you discover that listeners are, you know, epic masked men. I found anyway. I don't know about you, Ben.
Yeah, I imagine all of our listeners are masked men and women.
Yes.
Just sat at home, you know, some in luchador masks, some in like Florentine Renaissance masks.
Yeah, knights grilled helmets.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the rest of them just in Jason masks from Halloween.
Well, you know what they say, it's usually easier to talk to an audience if you picture them naked. But hey, masks work too.
Yeah. If you can't see the facial expressions, you can't know they're not smiling.
Oh, I imagine all of our audience are masked but naked.
I think that's a different show, boys.
Yeah. That's the other podcast we don't advertise.
So I wanted to ask about the team, the Nashville Predators. Firstly, because when I think of Tennessee, I think of country and western music, obviously, particularly Nashville. And I think of long, hot, languorous summer times where the humidity is
swamp
about...
weather.
Yeah, exactly. What is a nice hockey team doing there?
You know, the NHL wanted to try to expand into the American South. Honestly, it hasn't worked. They've given Atlanta, Georgia, three teams, all of which have moved. But it's working here. Team's been around for 26, 27 years now. And so the outreach is really starting to grow, and we're seeing the kids play. And
if it's that hot, presumably people want to be sat near a massive sheet of ice just to cool down now and again. Yeah,
it helps.
Yeah. When I thought of a Tennessee-based ice hockey team, I was like, you're the Make-A-Wish kid of the NHL. I thought, but you're not. You've won loads of trophies in the past few years.
It's been recent, but yeah, no, actually it used to be kind of the running gag for us here in the city that we were the team the league forgot. But but no, over the past few years, we found some players that really click. They get the chemistry together, and we've started to have some success, and it's been a lot of fun out here because of that.
And please tell me if this is bullshit, but this is what I found out. So the Detroit Red Wings had a tradition of throwing octopuses onto the pitch whenever they played.
Ice. And apparently, onto the rink.
Excuse me, onto the rink. I'm not used to an ice-based sporting arena, unless it's a particularly difficult Boxing Day fixture for Newcastle. But apparently, some of your fans have a ceremonial catfish that is launched onto the ice.
I see your octopus and I raise you a catfish.
it's the weirdest form of poker you'll ever play. But when the team first came around, there was a car plant that had transplanted a lot of Detroit citizens down to Nashville to build cars. Mm. And of course, they brought their Red Wings tradition with them. So whenever Detroit would come and play, they'd throw an octopus on our ice. And we had to figure out a way to counter that, especially as a young team that didn't have a huge fan base at the time. And catfish are pretty predominant here in Tennessee. Yeah. You can go catfishing just about in any lake or really hole in the ground. At a Detroit game, someone threw an octopus, and he ran down to the glass and tossed over a catfish, and a tradition was born.
Wow. And the catfish came away with 3 goals and 2 assists.
He did, actually. He did. He was the third star of the game.
Yeah. It sounds like, as well, like you were playing a real-life version of Pokemon.
Sure, I can go with that. It's a little bit different than the Magikarp, but hey, it works.
And the good thing is, you know, you've got the ice. You keep that catfish is going to keep fresh.
That's right. We fry them up afterwards.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. Obviously, as the ultimate predator, you are the greatest predator known to all. But what would be your one maybe kryptonite?
I'm a horrible, horrible cook.
Really?
I can figure out a way to burn a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I was going to say geography-based jokes, since apparently making a 4th of July joke didn't quite go over as planned with both of you gentlemen.
Yeah, Ulti did accuse me of being part of the English team on a worst foot forward. I had to distance myself from that and put myself firmly on the side of our fellow colonials across the pond.
Yeah, when we chatted via email, I forgot that today is obviously American Independence Day.
The day we're recording today.
So on behalf of Great Britain, I'd like to say you're welcome.
Yeah, because without the oppressor, you can't have an Independence Day,
precisely.
Can you?
On behalf of all Americans, I'd like to say happy Thursday.
Yeah.
This week we are talking about the world's worst disguise. We thought enlisting the help of a masked luchador was exactly the way to go about this, but we are starting off with the very much undisguised Ben Vandervelde. What have you learned?
We're going to begin by looking at World War One. So obviously the vast majority of World War One, you had the British and French army stuck in a war of attrition against the German army. The French army were trying to think, how can we get out into no man's land and how can we get closer to the enemy to get a better shot? So, an idea came up when one of their horses broke loose from the trench, which tells you everything wrong that you need to know about trench warfare.
So they decided to try and eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, the horse was like, I think I've got a better chance in no man's land than the French kitchens.
Yeah, yeah.
And ran out, got shot to death. And so the French looked at the horse's carcass and thought, hang on a minute, we could hide a soldier in that. And then they thought, no, that's disgusting. So under the...
They didn't decide to go full Tauntaun.
No. Under the cover of darkness, they went out into no man's land. They removed the horse carcass and replaced it with a papier-mâché horse. With a gun port situated in its anus.
Of course they did.
Because World War One and World War Two are the gifts that continue to keep giving, and you have an armored horse's ass.
They went with papier-mâché, so presumably there were some soldiers in the trench doing arts and crafts in advance of this.
Got to keep morale up somehow.
Yeah. At least it was that, rather than disguising two guys in a pantomime horse outfit and getting them to walk out.
This continued for 3 days until a German soldier spotted a man climbing out of the dead animal, presumably thinking that the horse had given birth to a man.
It's a miracle. Why isn't he a centaur?
I basically continued looking at things like camouflage, and I found out about something called dazzle camouflage.
Oh, well, it is Gay Pride this weekend.
Exactly. It was a type of ship camouflage in World War One and a little bit in World War Two, where basically they would disguise ships with complex geometric patterns that were meant to confuse radar, and it was influenced by cubism. So Paul Cézanne and Picasso.
Wait, are you saying an artistic movement inspired these martial tactics?
Yes.
So nowadays, we just treat all wars as if they're performance art pieces. Yes.
You go in as Picasso and come out as a Jackson Pollock.
Yeah. It's weird. I read two contrasting stories about them. Some said it was brilliant and it worked. They also worked with a British zoologist called John Graham Kerr, who worked with different types of animal camouflage as well. So they used patterns from giraffes, zebras...
On warships!
On warships! They also used mackerel colouring on the submarines.
When your team start throwing warship sized mackerel onto the ice, Ulti, then we have to really get worried.
I'm gonna aim for a battleship. Well, no, I should probably start smaller. Maybe a cruiser first.
Yeah, work your way up.
And I'll work my way up to an aircraft carrier. There's an American college football, not soccer, team in Idaho, Boise, Idaho, that their field or pitch is the same color as their uniforms.
Wow.
So I guess kind of in a way it'd be like camouflage, because if you watch it on television, it's kind of hard to tell.
I'm imagining their opponents trying to tackle the pitch then.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for it. I really am.
This is one of my favorite stories I've ever found. This is from the early 90s involving the American Fish and Wildlife Service. And they were on the verge of a major bust. The guy they were looking to close down was a gentleman called Victor Bernal, who's the director of zoos and parks for a Mexican state. He was desperate to replace his star attraction, which was a gorilla, even if it meant turning to the illegal exotic animal trade. He contacted an underground Miami animal dealer. And I know this sounds like I'm retelling the plot of Ace Ventura now, but I assure you I'm not.
I mean, that sounds like the most Miami profession ever.
Yeah, and this guy was actually running a sting operation for the US Fish and Wildlife Services.
Wow.
But the agents had a problem, as all agents do in this situation. In order to secure an arrest, they had to make the handover of the merchandise.
They had to fully entrap him.
They had to fully entrap him before they could arrest him. Right. Now, it's pretty difficult at the best of times for the federal government to just grab a gorilla willy-nilly, take it to Mexico, do the handover, and then arrest him. So they did what you think they are about to do. They dressed an agent up in a gorilla suit. A gentleman called Terry English, he was chosen to get into the suit. I imagine he had to draw the shortest banana. And he was also picked on the basis, and I quote from an article, that the agent was fairly proficient at ape-like sound effects. he was wheeled down to the airport, and they made things seem believable by whacking a bit of gorilla dung around the cage. And it worked. They were totally fooled. They bought into the disguise. Yeah, they transferred 95 grand to the suppliers, who immediately revealed themselves as undercover agents and placed him under arrest.
Great.
So at that point, Terry English, in his guise as the gorilla, pulled out a key, unlocked the cage, walked towards Bernal, who lost his shit because he still thought he was a real gorilla who was about to rip his head off.
I gotta see this costume. I'm picturing Planet of the Apes here, and
they did a lot of CGI work on the fly, I imagine.
In the late 60s, the SAS developed the 2A SAS Land Rover Pink Panther. And this was a pink Land Rover that was designed to aid their military operations in Oman. The theory was that the pink would help them blend in with the sunlight bouncing off the desert floor.
Right.
And this was a pink Range Rover that was loaded with smoke grenade launchers, a general purpose machine gun, anti-tank weaponries, blackout lamps, the whole,
wow,
the whole lot. But I don't know how effective it was. They used them in service for 16 years.
Okay.
But I love the idea of the British SAS just larking around the desert in Oman in a bright pink Range Rover.
Playing diddin, 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 diddin.
Yeah, that's the thing that gave them away.
Yeah.
I think we might have mentioned these lads before in a previous worst news of the week. There are a pair of burglars from America, Matthew McNelly and Joey Miller, 23 and 20 years old, who decided to disguise themselves by drawing black marker on their face.
Yeah.
And these photographs are incredible. They look like toddlers who've been left alone in the room for 5 minutes.
They couldn't afford a balaclava. They had no way of stealing a balaclava because they didn't have balaclavas. Just drawn black all over the face. It's very good.
What's really sweet is that the cops that arrested them seemed very understanding.
Yeah.
And said, for what it's worth, it appeared they'd been drinking quite a bit and maybe weren't thinking quite rationally.
Yeah, I like the other quote. One of them, Police Chief Jeff Kaler, said, "We're very skilled investigators, and the black faces gave them right away." I mean, quite easy to spot them.
I mean, I'll level with you. That sounds like a police report from, any time in American history.
yeah, it's about right.
But for my suggestion, we're going to go, stay in America, in fact, and go to the American Air Force. During the second Iraq War, the American Air Force changed its uniform, not because it had found superior camouflage, but because its chief of staff wanted something to look, in his words, distinctive, thus completely failing to understand the whole point of camouflage.
Yeah.
And so all of the planes and all of the uniform had a unique dark blue and light blue tiger stripe pattern. It might have been that he was trying to cover for what they were trying to do. They completely redesigned camouflage, and what happened was, because of the way human sight works, the camouflage was so many different colours that the human eye actually blocks them together as one big block colour. It's one of those weird tricks of the eye.
Trompe l'œil.
That's the one. It made the soldiers stand out more rather than less.
Rather than less. Great. But unless they were standing in front of a blue tiger, presumably.
Yes.
In which case, nailing it.
Yeah, well, they were like, we're fighting in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's near India, and hopefully because of climate change, India will get really cold, and it'll just be full of blue tigers.
They're playing the long game.
Yeah.
It sounds about like decent American logic.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And it cost them millions upon millions of pounds to design, and then more millions of pounds to redesign and use something that was actually effective. Basically, this existed for 7 years, and they were working in, particularly in Afghanistan, they were using a scheme that, like, bright blue planes and soldiers wandering around Afghanistan, and the Taliban go, there they are. Over there.
Well, I see in your notes there that the material was too hot for comfortable use in desert environments.
Yes, it was.
So not only that, but they're sweating profusely. Very, very nervous blue tigers.
Yeah, yeah. It was basically camouflage as designed by Dr. Zeus.
Ulti, batter up, as they don't say in your sport.
I have gone back through my inherent wrestling knowledge,
yes,
and have decided to use wrestling disguises for my worst disguises ever.
We love a wrestler on this show.
The history of most masked wrestlers is very long and very historic and very noble. The Mexican luchador would wear masks to represent a fighting force or a fighting spirit. The Japanese do the same with their masked wrestlers. And then there's America. Which I feel like is a pretty common theme when it comes to screwing up something that should be good.
Yeah, it's very much where if it's not America, if it's not Japan on this show, it's usually America. Is what we've learned.
In American wrestling, the masked wrestler usually came about because of a stipulation in a match. And most of the time it was some kind of loser leaves town or loser leaves the promotion type scenario, where if a wrestler were to lose against his opponent, he was done. He was gone. He had to leave forever. And of course, when you're one of the top draws in that company, you can't leave forever. For a couple of examples of this, before I get to my nomination of the worst ever, I'm going to go start a popular wrestler, but not necessarily a mainstream popular wrestler, and that would have been Terry Funk, who was known for hardcore wrestling. And the best part is there's a whole Funk family that goes along with Terry. And there's even a wrestling academy in Texas called Funk U. Because when your last name is Funk, the puns write themselves.
Yeah. Is that short for Funk University?
It is, yes, Funk University. And this one wasn't even a loser leaves town match. This one, he just decided to do it. So by this point in his career, Terry Funk had been wrestling all over the world. He was a major name in Japanese wrestling. He was kind of a king of the death match kind of wrestler. Made his appearance in WWF at the time television under the name Chainsaw Charlie, who carried a chainsaw to the ring, and decided to come out in a pantyhose mask. But still very, very obvious as to who's under the... It's not like he was hiding anything.
Yeah.
It's still Terry Funk. It was, and it lasted a good long time, and fans were kind of accepting. Yeah. They just kind of figured maybe he'd taken one too many shots to the head and just decided to be crazy.
And was this idea of the mask that you could, if your character got beaten and left town, you could just come back with a different mask? Was that the sort of thinking?
That gets into a couple of my next ones.
Okay, cool.
Famously, in my opinion, Dusty Rhodes. Mm-hmm. Everybody, if you're a wrestling fan at all, you know who Dusty Rhodes is. They've even styled a finish of a match called the Dusty Finish. He is irreplaceable. He is a legend and an icon in American wrestling. And very distinct vocal patterns and enunciation, very southern drawl, had a little bit of a lisp behind him, unmistakable body shape. And
which obviously
he was definitely not cut of the traditional wrestling mold, but a beloved icon. And I actually did know Dusty a little bit, and I love Dusty. So Dusty, this is not a shot against you, but this was pretty stupid.
But it's coming off the top rope.
Yes. Dusty lost one of these loser leaves town matches. At the time, it was with what would become WCW.
Okay.
Fast forward a couple of weeks, and there's a promo being shot outside at night. It's dark, and Willie Nelson's Midnight Rider playing in the background as a very distinct body mold with a very distinct lisp is wearing a black duster trench coat, a cowboy hat, and the worst mask ever. And in that very distinct Dusty drawl, he cuts a promo about how the Midnight Rider is coming to Jim Crockett Promotions and is going to avenge Dusty Rhodes, and the vengeance of Dusty Rhodes will be channeled through the Midnight Rider. Granted, they do make it a little obvious because they want the fans to keep interest.
Yeah.
But the sad part is everybody has to play it off as if this is legit. And even when, the bad guy who forced the good guy to leave town in the first place starts calling him out on it, of course, all of the other wrestlers and announcers and promoters and fans, no, it's not this guy. It's not Dusty Rhodes. It's not. It's so horribly obvious.
Do you think that's what's happened with Superman? And when he's Clark Kent, like, he's been totally down, but he's just got the glasses on now. They've got to pretend they don't know who he is. Everyone knows it's Superman.
They're just nice to him. No, Clark, we know. Yeah. We know.
I love with professional wrestling where, like, there's... It's all fake and it's all artifice and it's all soap opera, but there is a level where, like, even professional wrestlers are like, this is too wafer-thin bullshit for us.
I've been involved in stuff myself where I'm like, listen, this is just... No, I can't do this. This is just stupid.
It's also how far you have to into character and into the storyline you have to go.
Even today, I maintain the kayfabe with my mask. Very, very, very few people have seen me without it. And there are times where I won't go places if I can't get in without the mask.
Wow, nice. I mean, we can hear right now that you're wearing it.
He's wearing nothing else, though.
Yeah.
Just the mask.
Different show. I got that show later.
Yeah.
That's like an Eyes Wide Shut kind of show.
Yeah.
That was the original draft of that film, was it?
Yeah,
it was
just for all luchador wrestlers.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise really approved that script.
Yeah.
very much like his Scientology parties, anyway.
I'm going to get sued by a religion.
Come at us.
Going back to the wrestling and the masks, this one was not, it was a little bit of a loser leaves town match, but Andre the Giant, again. Oh, yeah. A very distinctive wrestler with a very distinctive look.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to recognize the fact that you're taller than everybody.
Yeah. And wider than everyone.
and wider.
Like
and
a building again, on legs.
Very distinct accent in his voice. Captain Lou Albano, famed wrestling manager, was trying to put together a stable of wrestlers, and he kept talking about the machine. The machine is coming. The machine is on his way. The machine will be here. The machine ended up being Andre the Giant in a mask.
I was really hoping he'd be dressed as a robot.
it might as well have been just a giant neon sign pointing and saying, no, really, it's Andre.
Yeah.
Once again, this one was actually wildly successful, though. They continued not only with Giant Machine, but they added to the stable of machines. Picked wrestlers that, again, looked relatively obvious under these masks, even though the mask does do a good job of hiding the face. Very still distinctive bodies and distinctive wrestling styles and, of course, vocal inflections. And they became a stable that ended up being managed by Captain Lou Albano. And this one actually did amount to some success and actually has come to some acclaim. But again, horrible disguise because it's Andre the crappin' freaking stupid giant.
I've just found on here as well, you can get, if you're a collector of these things, a toy of the machine.
Yes.
And it is the most S&M-looking wrestling toy I have ever seen.
I've got two more that I'm going to go with, and my winner will be announced here in a second. But for my next one, I'm going to go with a team that was actually a team at one point and then kind of became used as comedy fodder. In the early 80s, there was a team of luchadors called Los Conquistadores. Uh-huh. They were a legit team. They dressed in all gold, had gold masks, and they were not a comedy gimmick at the time. Fast forward to the Attitude Era of the 90s, and there was a giant feud between the Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian.
Yeah.
And these matches would spawn a feud that lasted almost a decade or more, and put together some phenomenal matches, sprinkle in the Dudley Boys, and you get some hardcore matches, and really it was a great, great, great gimmick. And as part of that, at one point, and now it's drawing a blank on who was the first one to get eliminated from TV for a minute. I think it was Edge and Christian that were forced off of TV for a while. Couple weeks later, they donned the old Los Conquistadores costumes, adopted horrible Spanish accents, and became a straight parody of this legit team.
I mean, it's not like the world of professional wrestling to be hugely culturally insensitive and
again. No, not at all. No, we're very culturally sensitive. They would interview Los Conquistadores, and one of them would speak broken Spanish, English, or a Spanglish kind of combination, and the other one would only say, ¿qué?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Watching Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
And then they would come out to whatever Conquistadors music they had at the time. And of course, the wrestling styles were distinctly Edge and Christian.
Yeah.
Eventually, they never unmasked, but eventually Edge and Christian were allowed to come back to TV. And the Hardy Boys were taken off of TV.
Mm.
And fast forward to the next week. And who shows up? But Los Conquistadores.
It sort of feels like the Beatles quitting and then a week later coming back as a wedding band.
It was played off for comedy, and at the time I was young enough that I didn't know Los Conquistadores, so to me it was comedy. But it was overall, in time, it's kind of like one of those things where you think a particular movie is just a phenomenal movie, and you go back and rewatch it in a more modern setting, and you just cringe.
I like that Ben has opened the Wikipedia page for the Hardy Boys. It has members, and then on that side has names: the Broken Hardys, the Hardy Boys, Los Conquistadores. That's one of the act names.
Yeah, it just it stands out like a sore thumb. Yeah. It really does.
It really does. So here is what I have decided as my official nomination for worst disguise ever. And I was kind of going back and forth on a couple of these, and decided, since we are recording on July 4th, which of course is a distinctly American holiday, mm-hmm. my nomination for worst disguise ever goes to Mr. America. So the story of Mr. America goes a little something like this. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, Hulk Hogan made his dramatic return to the WWE.
No.
He instantly was inserted into a feud with the owner of the WWE, Vincent Kennedy McMahon Jr. Hogan defeated Mr. McMahon, and the very next night on Raw, Mr. McMahon canceled and terminated Hulk Hogan's contract. The next night on WWE SmackDown, a very distinct song started playing throughout the arena as red, white, and blue confetti started showering the fans. Out from the stage entrance comes a very distinct mustache, who is, instead of wearing the traditional orange and yellow boas and orange and yellow tights, is wearing red, white, and blue flag stripe tights, a red, white, and blue boa, and a very distinct kind of stylized Captain America type mask.
Yes.
That, of course, does nothing to hide the mustache.
Yeah.
And he's doing all of the classic Hulk Hogan muscle poses, all of the classic cup the ear, try to get the crowd. It is absolutely, distinctly, 100% absolute Hulk Hogan madness. But because they could not get the mask off, and they could not prove that it was Hulk Hogan, he was allowed to wrestle for another couple of months under the Mr. America moniker. And of course, I understand you have to keep the kayfabe, and this is a way to get back at Mr. McMahon for firing Hulk Hogan. But come on! This one is slightly less obvious than Giant Machine. Slightly less obvious than Midnight Rider. It's Hulk Hogan, and the only way they got out of this gimmick was Hogan ended up being tired of being Mr. America, decided to wait out the rest of his contract and go home. So off-screen, they discovered Mr. America, fired him, and was never seen or heard from again.
He's also, the thing about luchadores, I've got an image of my mind that all luchadores are about 5'2", bullet-headed, barrel-chested little men, whereas Hulk Hogan is like a bunch of pipe cleaners that took too much whey protein. It's just, he's the wrong shape to be a luchadore.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, the tradition of Mexican wrestling is very high-paced, speed, flips, acrobatic endeavors, and very intense, high-paced wrestling. And if there were ever two words that did not describe a Hulk Hogan match, it would be high-paced and intense.
Yeah. And I mean, the least they could have done was shave the mustache off.
Or cover it with another mask. Again, Giant Machine.
A little mustache mask.
Just a little mustache mask. Giant Machine's mask. Giant Machine did nothing to disguise Andre the Giant, but at least it covered his face.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
But although I am kind of picturing now a little mustache mask, and I'm quite enjoying this, and I'm going to try to design one now.
Put goggly eyes on him and make him look like he just has a caterpillar on his upper lip.
Okay, let's workshop this, guys. How do you disguise Andre the Giant from the neck downwards?
You put giant haystacks in front of him. Like literal giant haystacks. Well, you put him on a massive diet. Or you get him to wear like one of those sumo suits that like stag parties wear. You know, the inflatable ones?
Yeah.
So then you can't really determine what size the body underneath that is.
Yeah, but if you put that on, it would just be like wearing a skin-tight scuba suit.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably him putting on Lycra.
Yeah.
I had a look at celebrity aliases, the names that celebrities use when they're, you know, booking into hotels and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Try and guess who uses some of these. This is Cash Money.
Is it June Carter Cash?
No, it's Jessica Alba. Apparently her husband is called Cash Warren.
That's the name that I give to my Swiss bank account.
Yeah. Harry Bollocks and Prince Albert. They were both used by the same person.
Harry Bollocks and Prince Albert.
I would have to think a very distinctive British celebrity.
Yeah, it is a Brit. Very famous.
Mick Jagger?
Well. No, not quite that. A bit more dark rock than that.
Ozzy Osbourne?
Yes, Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, that makes sense.
Bryce Pilaf.
Bryce Pilaf. Okay, are they Asian? Because it's a Bryce.
No.
Okay.
It's just like someone has mistyped this person's name.
Is it Edith Pilaf?
No, it's Brad Pitt. It's like some weird autocorrect has taken over. I also like Matt Damon has called himself Mr. President. which is great. It's right, that's up there with George Clooney checking in as Arnold Schwarzenegger because he finds it funny to make staff call him Arnold Schwarzenegger. Angelina Jolie goes by Miss Lollipop. Jennifer Aniston calls herself Mrs. Smith, which is a bit disturbing given that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie met on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Wow.
That puts a whole new level on it.
Yeah, right. Kid Rock goes by Dick Grayson, as in Robin's real name.
Oh wow, we found something vaguely endearing about Kid Rock.
Right. Slash, the rocker goes by IP Freely, classic Simpsons gag there. Jay-Z has checked in under the name Frank Sinatra.
All the time in the world for that. Yeah.
Kate Beckinsale wins the prize with Sigourney Beaver.
Wow.
Kim Kardashian goes with Princess Jasmine. Justin Timberlake, Mr. Wood Pond. Timberlake. Wood Pond, yeah. Justin Bieber, Chandler Bing. Then we get to some of the really highfalutin ones. Johnny Depp goes by Mr. Drip Noodle, Mr. Odd Pong, and Mr. Stench, which at least shows some element of self-awareness. Britney Spears, Queen of the Fairy Dance, Mrs. Abracadabra, and Mrs. Diana Prince, because she liked Princess Diana. Elton John's are very good. Sir Humphrey Handbag, Sir Pinky Poodle Clip, and Judas Fart. But hands down my favourite one, I'm never going to give him up, is Rick Astley going by the name Dick Spatsley. You mentioned bank robbers.
Yep.
In 1995, a guy robbed two Pittsburgh banks in broad daylight, not wearing any sort of disguise, but he smiled at the surveillance cameras as he walked out. Later that night, police arrested MacArthur Wheeler and they showed him the surveillance tapes and he was aghast. He said, "But I wore the juice." Apparently Wheeler thought that if you rubbed lemon juice on your skin, it would render him invisible because we use lemon juice as invisible ink.
No way.
Yes,
wow.
Yeah.
That is a whole new level of stupid.
He thought he should be completely invisible. They just thought, police decided he wasn't crazy, just really, really mistaken. This case caught the eye of psychologist David Dunning at mm-hmm. Cornell University.
Is this of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Alongside graduate student Justin Kruger.
Yeah!
And they came to the conclusion that while everyone sort of holds favourable views of their own abilities, some people mistakenly assess their abilities as being much higher than they actually are. This illusion of confidence is called the Dunning-Kruger effect. The less qualified you are to do something, the more qualified you actually think you are, and vice versa. The more qualified you are to do something, the less highly you think
it's sort of anti-imposter syndrome.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I went back in history then a bit, read about the French Revolution. When the French royal family were fleeing Paris in the wake of the revolution, they came up with a plan. They had a general, François-Claude de Bouillet, had a force that was sort of very loyal to the king still in Montmédy down the south, and they wanted to get down there. So the king disguised himself as a valet and the queen was disguised as a governess. And Marie Antoinette loved dressing up anyway. This must have been the most exciting day of her life. And they dressed the kids up, and I think they dressed one of the princes as a girl and to sort of like confuse people, and they snuck out. The king and Marie Antoinette left separately and then they joined up together. The king didn't want them to travel separately and they had quite a large family. And so they had a really big, yellow, slow-moving coach with six horses pulling it, rather than a couple of small, quicker coaches. So the coach, it's basically like they'd hired a double-decker bus to transport them, like this lowly group of servants and children, through France at 11 kilometres an hour. The postmaster in a town recognised the king, apparently from his portrait on the coins. And they were captured at a town called Varennes.
I love the idea of a postmaster seeing this coach going past really slowly with the king and getting a coin out of his pocket and just holding it up,
yeah,
to be seeing as it goes past.
Yeah. Mary, Queen of Scots, escaped from Loch Leven Castle, which is on an island. She had a couple of attempts. first of all, tried to disguise herself as a washerwoman, but the boatman saw how clean her hands were and said, "You're not a washerwoman."
That's the classic Toad of Toad Hall disguise.
Yeah, exactly. And then she escaped a second occasion on May the 2nd, 1568, when her accomplices drugged the island with wine. They gave lots of wine to all the guards and the people in the castle and got them really pissed.
I love that if you go far enough back in history, that is a legitimate tactic.
Yeah.
That's like nowadays we look at that and it's like this is some fairy tale nonsense, but if you haven't got any access to a bit of ether,
yeah, then exactly,
just get the guards pissed and nick the keys.
They also pegged the boats to the shore, so they really rammed the ropes down so that they couldn't be chased too quickly. Charles II, when he was fleeing England in the wake of the Revolution and the Civil War, he was very tall. He was 6 foot and he had a very tanned complexion and a deep voice, and he was very sort of regal bearing. So he actually had people coach him how to, you know, do an accent and walk like a poor person.
Oh dear.
to help him escape from us. He disguised himself as a manservant to a woman whose name was Jane Lane, who also sounds like somebody, like was a guy in disguise as well. I also read about King Matthias Corvinus of Hungary. He was crowned in 1464, a very popular guy. And he was at war with Turkey. Apparently, he disguised himself as a sort of a food vendor and went to the Turkish camp and sold, you know, fruit and veg outside the Turkish general's tent. The next day, sent a message to the general describing the camp in detail, which freaked out the Turkish general so much that he'd actually like been inside without anyone seeing him that they fled.
That's a hell of a baller move.
Yeah, I really, really like that.
That's actually pretty damn good. That's like the reverse loser leaves town match.
Yeah. I've one more really cool story to tell you before my actual suggestion. So apparently Pope Francis sneaks out of the Vatican at night and works for charities and things and disguises himself.
It's a real indictment of the Catholic Church when the Pope has to sneak out to do charitable work.
Yes.
And they're just going, this isn't really what being Pope is about.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
about
yeah.
the women and the booze.
Why did you get into poping? Well... my dad was a pope. And his dad before him. Have you ever heard of a film called The Scarlet and the Black? It was a TV movie from the 80s starring Gregory Peck.
No.
My granny was a big fan of this film, and because of concern, a Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, an Irish priest who was in the Vatican during World War II, he helped to care for nearly 4,000 men who were wanted by the Gestapo. He and a team of co-conspirators ran what became known as the Rome Escape Line, and he hid these POWs and wanted people in the Vatican. He got them enrolled in the Palatine Guard or hid them in monasteries and convents and in private homes all over the country and all over the city, finding safe houses. He had one safe house that he rented, which backed up against the hotel that the SS were using as their headquarters. He basically said, they won't look. It's the last place to look, right under their noses. And he also helped people avoid raids and distributed food and money and so on. They were often helped along the way by the Irish ambassador's wife, Delia, and her daughter to reach Monsignor O'Flaherty using their diplomatic car. The Germans appointed a guy called Herbert Kappler as Hitler's sort of representative in Rome. And he was so angry about this, he painted a white line around the streets around the Vatican City and said that basically if they ever caught Monsignor O'Flaherty outside that white line, he would be shot. The story of the people who helped him is really impressive. He had help from a Princess Nini Pavlicini. She printed fake food coupons so they could get food, because obviously rationing was underway, and so mm-hmm. she helped feed so many people who wouldn't have otherwise had these coupons. There was a British army officer called Sam Derry who escaped from a POW train on its way to the concentration camps, came back to Rome, and helped coordinate a lot of it. There was a Maltese widow called Henrietta Chevalier who had 7 children of her own, and she got them to dance and played music on her gramophone to drown out the noise of all the other guests who were in her house that she was housing. But O'Flaherty himself was known to disguise himself. Once they suspected he was in the home of a guy called Prince Filippo Doria, who actually became mayor of Rome after the war. And Kappler and dozens of the SS officers arrived almost immediately. They'd been watching this place. They thought, you know, this was one of the safe houses. They showed up. The prince's staff delayed them for just long enough that the Monsignor sort of hid down in the basement, found that there was a coal delivery taking place. And so he climbed onto the coal pile, you know, got a bag from the street from where the delivery was taking place, filled it up, put his own cloaks inside it, put on some coal dust and grabbed some clothes from one of the coal men who saw him and walked right out past the SS guys as a coal delivery guy.
Love it.
He'd go out disguised as a labourer. He'd sometimes walk out with a woman on his arm, so he'd deflect suspicion because he wouldn't expect that to be a priest. And apparently also disguised himself as a nun on one occasion. His nickname was the Scarlet Pimpernel of the Vatican. But my choice for the world's worst disguise also comes from World War II. I'm going to talk about Operation Grief, which means griffin in German.
Mm-hmm.
Waffen-SS commando Otto Skorzeny earned the favour of Hitler because he managed to oversee the kidnapping of the son of the regent of Hungary and force his resignation. And he returned to Germany, and Hitler asked him to come and meet him. This is in October 1944. Congratulated him and outlined the planned offensive in the Ardennes and the role that he wanted him to play. And he wanted Skorzeny to form a brigade called the Panzer Brigade 150, whose purpose would be to capture a couple of the bridges over the Meuse River before the Allies could destroy them. I want you to command a group of American and British troops and get them across the Meuse and seize one of the river and seize one of the bridges.
No, seize the river. Hitler asked for an awful lot.
Because the river was disguised the same colour as the men that they were. and seize one of the bridges. Not, my dear Skorzeny, real Americans or British. I want you to create special units wearing American and British uniforms. They will travel in captured Allied tanks. Think of the confusion you could cause. I envisage a whole string of false orders which will upset communications and attack morale. So Hitler decided to disguise German soldiers as Allied soldiers to confuse the Allies.
Oh, I think I know where this is going.
Oh, it's going. Wait till you see. Oh, this is great. Now, he only had 5 or 6 weeks to recruit and train this brand new unit. So he basically had to find soldiers who could speak English and the American dialect. So they put out this request to every headquarters, and this was intercepted by the Allies. So the Allies already knew what was going on. He found 10 men who spoke perfect English and had some knowledge of US idioms, 30 to 40 men who spoke English well but had no slang, and 120 to 150 who spoke English moderately well, and 200 or so who had learned English at school. So imagine being drafted into the British Army having to... What did you do at school? Did you do German?
I did a little bit of German and some French.
So they're relying on you to pass as a German soldier. So he scaled down the size of the brigade from 3 battalions to 2, got the 150 best English speakers into one sort of elite commando unit, and they eventually had 2,500 men, 800 fewer than the number they'd hoped for. They didn't really find enough equipment as well. They had like 4 US Army scout cars and some jeeps and some trucks. They painted German vehicles in the US colours and with Allied markings. They only had a single Sherman tank. And so they disguised Panzer tanks as M10 tank destroyers by taking off bits of them. And they also had, you know, Polish and Russian equipment sent by units who didn't really know what they were being asked for. They saw it, so they thought, oh, they just want some equipment. No, they specifically needed the equipment of the Allies. And then the problem was that they also needed to be identified by their own forces. So they had a little yellow triangle painted on the back of the vehicles, and tanks would point their guns at 9 o'clock, and that troops would have sort of scarves of pink or blue, or they'd take their helmets off, or they'd have different torches. They were basically like, we need to avoid friendly fire at all costs. They had these plans, and in December they set off to do it, and they had this sort of advance party where we were going to try and clear the way for them, and the advance party did not get through in time, and already Skorzeny realised this operation was not going to go successfully. He suggested, okay, listen, this whole secret plan thing's not going to work, let's just use the brigade as a real army unit now. They managed to convince one US Army unit to withdraw from Poteau on the 16th of December, and another group switched around some road signs and sent a US regiment in the other direction, and that was basically as far as their mischief went. But it was enough to cause a bit of confusion. US troops began asking other soldiers questions that only Americans would know the answer to,
mm-hmm.
to flush out the Germans, including like questions about state capitals and sports and trivia stuff. That meant that...
They
did a little pub quiz.
Yeah.
That a quick round of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And that led to the US Brigadier General Bruce Clark being held at gunpoint because he incorrectly said that the Chicago Cubs were in the American League. They weren't. They were in the National League at the time. And another captain was spent a week in detention because he was wearing boots that were from a German make. General Omar Bradley was repeatedly stopped in his car by checkpoint guards who just seemed to be enjoying the fact that they could stop him and order him to answer their questions. According to one guy, Paul Fussell, there was a typographical error on US identity cards. The top of a US identity card at the time said, not a pass, for identification purposes only. They'd misspelled the word identification. Mm-hmm. So the Germans, making the disguises, couldn't resist correcting the mistake. And so their cards read for identification purposes only, which gave them away.
There's something a little bit too beautiful that it's the word identification being misspelled that makes them able to be identified.
44 German soldiers got through the US lines, and all but 8 of them returned. So they did, you know, they caused a little bit of confusion, not on the scale they hoped for. A German commando team was captured near Aiwale on the 17th of December. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. And one member managed to convince the Allies that Skorzeny intended to capture General Eisenhower and his staff. And because Skorzeny had obviously managed that infiltration job in Hungary and he'd rescued Mussolini and all of that, the Americans believed this and they made Eisenhower spend Christmas 1944 in isolation for security reasons.
Wow.
Yeah. After several days in confinement, he stormed out of his office angrily declaring he had to get out and he didn't care if anyone tried to kill him.
This is like the either the best or the worst episode of Hogan's Heroes ever.
It's right up there. Not only that, Montgomery, Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, the commander of the British forces, they didn't get on, he and Eisenhower. He took off in his staff car towards Malmedy to try and appear among the US troops while Eisenhower was confined. And he didn't know that there was another rumour going around that one of Skorzeny's commanders looked a lot like Monty. And had identified himself as such. And so US guards stopped Monty's car at a checkpoint. Monty told them he would not put up with such nonsense, ordered the driver to keep going. The guards angrily shot out his tires, dragged him out of his car to a nearby barn and detained him for several hours. Monty was so enraged he called for the court-martial of the US privates if they didn't release him. He was insulted they didn't even recognise him in the first place, and he was released only after a British captain showed up and said, no, it's definitely him. Apparently Eisenhower was so pleased, he said it was the best thing Skorzeny had ever done.
World War One. I think the impression I get of both World Wars is that there were about 25 actual combatants in each of them, all pretending to be someone else.
Yeah.
And none of them working. It almost comes across more Benny Hill than military warfare. Yeah.
I like the fact that they decided to turn some signs around and all that. Like, it's just proper April Fool's Day pranks. Next up, they're putting cling film over Monty's toilet. So, our candidates this week for the world's worst disguise are Ben's suggestion of the US Air Force's distinctive tiger stripes from the Iraq War II era, Ulti's suggestion of Mr. America, aka very definitely Hulk Hogan, and my suggestion of Operation Grief, the German plan, basically somewhere straight out of a Carry On film. A couple of bits of warfare and some wrestling. Oh, I don't know. I think the Mr. America seems so half-hearted. I feel like there's so little effort in it. It's nearly not good enough to be a worse disguise. The US Air Force, I mean, it seems like a fashion decision going around. They probably put lots of effort into it, into thinking, yeah, this is the perfect configuration of all of these stripes and stuff. I love Operation Grief. It's a World War II story. Of course it's going to win. If you want to win on this episode, you got to present a World War II. If you'd said to me that Hulk Hogan wrestled during World War II, Ulti, you'd have had a chance.
He's almost old enough to. That's a film I'd like to watch. Hulk Hogan gets sent back in time
Hulk
to wrestle.
Hulk Hogan's Heroes.
Yes!
Only if he actually takes part in Operation Grip.
Yes. In which case, yeah, well, let's go with that this week. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's worst news of the week. This is actually from a couple of weeks ago. A Toronto-based novelist, Harriet Alida Lai, posted on Twitter recently how her cousin in the UK, Siobhan Casey, had asked her colleagues at the Hope for Chronic Conditions charity for a Mariah Carey-themed cake to mark her birthday. Mm-hmm. What a lovely thing, because she's a big Mariah Carey fan. Only problem is their colleagues misheard her and presented her with a cake with Marie Curie's face on it. The Nobel Prize winning scientist, and instead of the world famous singer of holiday classic, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
I mean, I'd like to hope that they didn't go full commitment to make it a radioactive cake.
Yeah, it is a very beautiful cake. It looks like some sort of chocolate sponge with Marie Curie's picture imposed on it, and then seven little cupcakes around the edges of it. The picture of Siobhan being presented with the cake is really, like, she's wearing a happy, sad smile.
Yeah.
they obviously, this went viral. I'm so, so pleased. Apparently, Mariah Carey saw it herself. And she tweeted, "This could have been me if only I hadn't failed remedial math."
Although, have you heard Marie Curie's rendition of All I Want for Christmas?
Before we go, Ulti, where can people find out more about you and your team and anything else like that?
You can follow me on Twitter. That's where I typically reside at I am Ultimate Pred. I play along with anybody who plays along with me. So don't be afraid to goof off with me and have some fun. Nashville Predators, of course, the NHL. Find me floating around Bridgestone Arena if you're in Nashville at any point in time. And I want to give a quick shout out to the woman who turned me on to you guys. Courtney Taylor, my ever beautiful and loving girlfriend, thank you so much for turning me on to you guys. And guys, yeah, thank you so much for having this goofball on here.
You're very kind. And a shout out to Courtney as well, longtime fan of the show, and very, very lovely Twitter interactions with her.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Thanks to both of you.
Well, we're all off to have a tag team match. It's Ulti and Hulk Hogan against you and me dressed as Monty and Eisenhower. Thank you for listening to The Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.